Hey everyone, and how you be? This is The Takeaway with Melissa Harris-Perry, here and you there, and my control room squad on the other side of the glass. We got an hour-long political schmooze here on the show, so let's drop the needle.
Did something that's long overdue, that long has been talked about in Washington, but never actually been done. The House of Representatives passed an Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. That's a fancy way of saying a bipartisan infrastructure bill, a once-in-a-generation investment that's going to create millions of jobs.
Finally, it's done. Candles were burned on both ends. Noses were scarred on the grindstone. Tigers were grabbed by the tails and cats were herded into alignment.
Mass hysteria!
It wasn't easy, elegant, or pretty, but reconciliation was achieved. The $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill passed both chambers of the U.S. Congress, promising historic investments in roads, bridges, energy, broadband, and more. Now, the final House vote, 228-206, that was with six progressive Democrats in opposition and 13 Republicans in favor. But for those 13 Republicans, the last week has been rough. Former President Donald Trump has said they should be ashamed of themselves for helping the Democrats. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene called for challengers to mount primary campaigns against the 13 members who voted yes. And some of those members have reported receiving threats of harm and violence from those who are angry about their decision to break partisan ranks. With me is Brendan Buck, a Republican strategist at Seven Letter, and a former aide to Republican speakers of the House, John Boehner and Paul Ryan. Brendan, thanks again for being here on The Takeaway.
Yeah, it's great to be talking with you again.
All right, so let's start with the bill, and then we'll talk about the way it got passed. Can you just say a bit about why the infrastructure bill might matter to Americans, regardless of their partisan identification?
Sure. You know, infrastructure is one of the most basic things that Congress does. And what this bill actually is a plussed up version of this, of the kind of infrastructure bill, the highway bill, that Congress does basically every 5 or 6 years. We did one about 6 years ago and it was expiring. And Republicans and Democrats came together and used this as an opportunity to do a broader infrastructure bill. So they took the normal bill that's about $500, $600 billion and tacked another $550 billion on top of it. And so what you have is just this monster sprawling infrastructure bill that will talk about, that will touch roads, bridges, those normal things that you consider, but also broadband. And a lot of other things that are important to communities these days. So, you know, it's one of those things that usually is not controversial. And typically when you pass a large infrastructure bill like this, you get pretty big majorities voting for it. But perhaps the size and some of the politics associated with it made it a little different this time around.
So, Brendan, it's exactly that little different this time around that I want to dig into a bit, because I feel like what you've communicated here is like, you know, if you're going to go work in Congress 101, right, you pass a bipartisan bill where folks can actually show the people back home, right? Look, I brought this project. See how your road is clearer. Notice how your you know, internet is faster. See how the water is coming out of your pipes more swiftly and without lead. I did that, right? And there was always this idea that like service to constituents through this kind of infrastructure was a win for everybody. But somehow by connecting this with politics, it actually moved us away from that. I'm wondering what that tells you about how Washington is working or not working these days.
Sure. The old axiom is that all politics is local. And you're right. You used to be able to just say, I've delivered for my constituents. Here's what I've done for you locally. And that was enough to get by. That doesn't really hold true as much anymore. I think reality is that all politics is national now, and there is a national trend that certainly in the Republican Party that anything big is bad, anything working with Democrats is bad, and that's what you saw here. But really, I think the biggest dynamic that makes this different is less to do about the infrastructure bill at all, and it is that the infrastructure bill was perceived as tied to the separate social spending bill that Democrats are pushing through Congress. And I think Republicans and Democrats, too, bought into what I think is a fiction that the outcome of the infrastructure bill in any way changed what is going to happen with the other social spending bill. And so it wasn't so much that Republicans are getting heat for voting for an infrastructure bill. It's that they are somehow perceived as advancing and helping the other bill that every Republican, frankly, is against.
This is interesting to me. So do you think that heat is about misunderstanding or is it about like actual confusion about what it is that just got passed? I mean, I always have to remind myself, not everyone is, you know, obsessively poring over every detail of the congressional, you know, record on a daily basis.
Yeah, no, look, I think there are definitely Republicans who will say, I'm opposed to a bill that is this large. It adds something like $200 billion to the deficit. It's just too much government spending. I mean, that is not an unusual Republican position, but that's really not what the debate has been about. The debate has been that shortly after the Senate passed the infrastructure bill with, remember, 69 votes in the Senate, there were 19 Republicans who voted for it in the Senate, and there really wasn't much uproar at all. But right after that happened, Nancy Pelosi said that the House was not going to vote on it right away. They were going to wait until this Build Back Better Act was ready to pass as well. And that immediately changed the dynamic. From that moment on, infrastructure and the social spending bill were tied together. And so Republicans have bought into this idea that passing one passes the other. I think that is just wrong. I think that infrastructure, a bill like this that is pretty basic, that passed the Senate with almost 70 votes, was always going to become law, whether it became law recently or whether the fighting went on for another year. At some point, Democrats were going to be able to put up the votes to pass that. So I just think that they read the politics wrong, or at least they read the legislative process wrong. But, you know, perception is reality. And right now the perception is that 13 Republicans helped advance the Joe Biden agenda. And that's why they're getting some heat.
For those 13 Republicans, how likely is it that they may, in fact, lose their seat either to a primary challenge or, you know, across partisan lines?
Well, you have to look at the makeup of these 13. Half of them are from New York and New Jersey. This is a Republican Party that is increasingly at risk of becoming a rural Southern party. And it's a Republican Party that's trying to take back the House. And I think to be a viable majority, you have to realize that some of your members in different parts of the country need different things. And I think in the Northeast and some of these Midwestern districts, people that voted for it, they still expect you to come home with money to fix that road, fix that bridge, fix that dam. So, you know, I think that those folks were doing what is good for their district and is probably not terribly damaging to them. Three of them, at least, have already announced they're retiring. So that sort of frees them up a little bit. But I don't think there's actually going to be too much trouble for them. I actually predict this is going to blow over just based on the makeup of who they are, where their district is, that people there actually care about those things. But also a handful of those other members are ones that are really the majority makers. If you're going to have a majority, you can't lose a John Katko of upstate New York or a Fred Upton of Michigan, who voted for this. These are members that when I was there, we always had to convince to run again because, you know, their district's tough. Their reelection is always tough. And we always feared that if they didn't run again, the seat would go to Democratic hands. So I think that what you're going to see is Republican leadership stepping in and saying, hold on, let's leave these guys alone. We need them if we're going to take back the majority.
All right. So that actually leads me, because I'm always presuming that it's more complicated than whatever it is we see on the surface. So if you've got a couple of folks who were already not seeking reelection, more than half who are in what should be at least ideologically safe based on this vote districts, then is this in fact in part performative? In other words, does it help the more conservative members to convince others not to run against them in a primary by kind of shouting at, yelling at their colleagues, even though they acknowledge and recognize, even if they won't, you know, with a kind of a wink, wink and a nod, that it's not actually going to harm those 13, but it allows them to, again, continue to kind of stand against Biden.
Well, I mean, certainly it helps the more conservative members in deeper red districts to make the point that over their dead body, were they going to vote for something like this? But I do want to say this is different. The fact that you had Marjorie Taylor Greene posting the phone number of these 13 members on Twitter, encouraging her followers to call them. That is not normal to have your conference openly shooting at each other like that. So, you know, I don't want to say that this is just them playing to their local politics. It is relatively dysfunctional. And I think there are probably going to be some pretty hurt feelings. A lot of those 13 who voted for it are some of the more popular members in the conference. And I wouldn't be surprised if when they come back in session soon, that there is a conversation about how this is incredibly unproductive, not only just, you know, being a team, but also, again, trying to threaten the ability for members to come back when you are so close to taking back the majority. You know, that I think that is largely what is driving this. Republicans are so convinced that they are going to take back the House that they almost feel like some of their less conservative members are expendable at this point. And I just don't think that's a very wise approach.
Is there a fight for the soul of the Republican Party underway?
I don't think so. I think the soul of the Republican Party has been pretty much in the Trump camp for a while now. There's, you know, there may be a fight for what is the best political approach to regain power. But I think the base of the party is still very firmly in the Donald Trump camp. You know, what happened in Virginia with the governor's race aside, you can't really advance in Republican politics by being on the other side of what I call the Trump question. You know, whether you support him, whether you can at least tolerate him. So I wish there was more of a fight going on, but I think it's already, that fight has already happened, and Donald Trump and his supporters have won it.
Brendan Buck is a Republican strategist at Seven Letter and a former aide to Republican speakers of the House, John Boehner and Paul Ryan. Brendan, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Time for a pop quiz. Now, this is an easy one. It's just a repeat of the question you answered when you completed your census form last year. I mean, you did complete your census form, didn't you? Okay, here's the question. Choose the category that identifies your race. White, Black or African-American, American Indian and Alaska Native, Asian, or Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander. Or you can choose two or more races. Cool, pencils down. All right, that was easy. Well, maybe. I mean, what box do you choose if your grandparents are from Algeria, Morocco, or Egypt? All those countries are part of the continent of Africa. Would that make you African-American? What if your parents recently immigrated from Syria or Lebanon? Should you mark Asian? This is the experience Arab Americans face with each government-required questionnaire, from the census to college admissions to job applications.
Now, on the United States Census form, if you check some other race, And you put in an Arab country, do you know what happens to that form? Do you know what happens to that form? You know what they do with that form? They don't burn it. They don't give it to the FBI. They actually file it with white people. Did you know that? Yes. According to the federal government, we're white. White. Scary, right? For you, not for us.
That was comedian Amer Zaire, finding some humor in the distance between how Arab Americans see themselves and how the federal government identifies and responds to the community. Shunting Arab Americans into the category of white Americans, but then treating them as not quite Americans. And it isn't a new problem. Back in the early 20th century, the Department of Justice heard a case on whether people from the Middle East could claim they were white in order to be allowed U.S. citizenship, or if they were Asian, which meant they could not. George Shashim, the Arab American on trial, told the court that he came from the same place as Jesus. So, of course, the ruling found that people from the Middle East were now white. Whoa. But advocates say that people from the Middle East have since become invisible in the U.S. as a result. And for decades, Arab American organizations have pushed the federal government to adjust official forms to stop what they say is an erasure of a community. But the question is, just who is a person of color? And are Arab Americans part of that group? For more, I spoke with historian and professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, Sarah Gualtieri, and Maya Berry, the executive director of the Arab American Institute. Maya started off by explaining the internal and external identifications of Arab Americans as people of color.
I actually talk about it exactly that way. I start by explaining that there is our identity, how we identify as individuals, and not even collectively, right? There's the sense of how each individual Arab American will identify, and then this externally imposed classification on us that comes from other sources. We're talking about a community of roughly 3.7 million Arab Americans in this country, and they identify with their national origin and ethnicity, and they don't fit in nicely into the racial classifications in terms of how people at least understand this. There are Black Arabs, there are white Arabs, there are brown Arabs. So it's a lot like the Latino community in terms of ethnicity and not necessarily a racial classification. And then we have this burden of being a community that's really often misunderstood for a variety of reasons that I trust we'd get into, but it does play into how this conversation plays out.
Yeah, Sarah, I think I just kind of want to ask you similarly this question of both internal self-identification and external identification of Arab Americans as people of color.
Yes, well, when I look at the, you know, over 150-year history of Arab American experience of race in the United States, I see so many instances of racial terror that I can't help but understand their experience as being that of a minoritized population. So very sadly, I could spend this entire segment enumerating cases of racial violence from the 1929 lynching of a Lebanese grocer in Florida to the 1985 assassination of Alex Ode, who was the West Coast Regional Director of the Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, or the 2015 murder of three Arab Muslim college students in Chapel Hill. So I understand this violence, like as a historian, I understand this violence to be fueled by ideas about their difference from a group of people understood to be white American. And I think that historically there has always been this tension whereby Arabs have been pulled out through external factors. They've been pulled out of this category of American. And I think that is where we find ourselves in a very fraught situation, and where you have longstanding communities in the United States who are quintessentially American, and yet there is a perception that they are always outsiders.
So this is interesting. And I'm wondering about the moments when that difference gets highlighted. Sarah, as a historian, maybe you can walk us through a few of the key historical moments, and then Maya, I'll come to you as well.
So what makes this conversation so interesting and nuanced, I think, is that there are moments in which Arab communities do access the privileges of whiteness, right? So if we're trying to understand this disconnect, you know, why is it that when you look at the census that Arabs are expected to classify themselves as white, and yet the lived experience of so many Arab Americans is clearly not as white citizens? Where does that disconnect come from? So in the early part of the 20th century, race was so connected to ideas of citizenship. There was, in fact, a racial requirement for citizenship. Briefly, the George Shisham case is a really interesting case that unfolded here in Los Angeles in 1909. And one of the reasons I like to talk about this case is because there tends to be a perception that questions of race and racial identity as they relate to Arab Americans, particularly in this early part of the 20th century, that they unfolded particularly in the Jim Crow South. And the Shisham case points to the fact that these debates were unfolding nationwide, right? So George Shisham was a police officer in Venice, California. He arrested a young person and was at first unable to give testimony in court against him because it was deemed that George Shisham was not a white person. And this drew on earlier legislation that basically said that people of color, or the language of the statute doesn't use that term, but Chinese, Black people, they could not give testimony in court against a white person. And so George Shisham decides to get his naturalization, to get his citizenship, and to do so by conforming to the statute, which meant litigating his status as a white person.
Maya, I'm wondering if you can speak a bit to that, that sense of allyship, perhaps in the most recent moment, although 20 years now is perhaps not that recent, but I'm thinking the ways that, again, the post 9/11 moment ends up conflating in American discourse, Arab American identity, Muslim identity, and then this kind of outsider status.
For me, the issue, it really does predate even the post 9/11 environment that we see. You know, I always start with Richard Nixon's Operation Boulder and the targeting of Arab students in this country who are engaged in advocacy for Palestinian human rights. It's been a defining issue in terms of the political exclusion that we've faced. And you know, the context of your question, right, is American identity white is part of what we're kind of talking about. Now, my answer is no, right? But the way that it's played out, particularly in a post 2016 presidential election, there's like this new way to understand Du Bois's new religion of whiteness, right? Like there's, and the way we fit into that is so interesting, partly for me, based on this most recent election of the mayoral candidate in Boston, who is an Arab American woman who had to deal with a headline that said, "Boston mayoral candidate says she's a person of color. Is she?" So as a community, we are literally rendered invisible by government data. We have been fighting to get a new category on the census, a Middle East and North Africa category that would allow us to go in and collect more accurate information about Arab Americans for decades. We were there for 2020 until, regrettably, the Trump administration politicized the census in an unprecedented way. And then the category, movement on the category, was abandoned, though it was tested in 2015 and found to be a proper way, a more accurate way to gather data on this. So we're rendered invisible in that, and then highly visible and targeted by government policies that have securitized us as a community that our fellow Americans sort of need to view us as differently. So for me, when I talk about these issues, it's like I have these four buckets I put it in. And I always start with the identity piece, because I think that's really important, which is how I choose to identify may be different than how Sarah does or how you do, Melissa. And that's the point of this conversation. We get to choose that. But there's a second piece of it, which is how we're classified by our government. And the issue of the census is just critical. It's done real and tangible harm to local communities when we don't have the appropriate data to be able to provide things like English as a second language program to appropriate political representation. But there's also the way we're seen by others, the way we're perceived by our other fellow Americans, right? And I gotta tell you, for the first time, we do a lot of polling on American attitudes. And for the first time ever that we got to the point of the majority of Americans not having a negative view of Arab Americans was in 2017, where we finally broke to 52%. And by the way, that's
when had that question first been asked?
We started doing polling on American attitudes in the late 90s, tracking it exactly the same way from 2010. But we've asked it differently dating back to the 90s. And I'll tell you, it broke at 52%. When we asked the question about Arabs, not Arab Americans, we didn't break 50. It was still at 42%. So this anti-Arab bigotry is real, and it's part of what we have to deal with. And then the final point I would make is, in terms of my buckets of understanding this, is that there's an element here in terms of how we're treated by state power, how we are profiled, how we're viewed in the context of counterterrorism policies, how we're talked about when it comes to immigration policies. And when we talk about, you know, working in coalition with partners, the profiling guidance that's in place right now continues to allow profiling on border security, national security, and local law enforcement.
I want to come back to you, Sarah, to talk a little bit about sort of what you hinted at previously around acts of violence. You told us a few of them. Some of them are quite familiar to me, others not so much. I'm wondering if you could, and again, this is tough to do, but if you could help us to understand sort of, at least in the past maybe two or three decades, a reflection on state violence. And then we can talk a bit also about citizen-on-citizen violence.
I think in the case of Arab Americans, you so often seen this kind of this pairing of violence that is carried out against individual Arab Americans. So a woman is walking down the street in Chicago and her hijab is pulled off her head, or she's spat upon. Or so we might characterize that as a individualized violence carried out by one person upon another. But I think that what's important to hold on to here is that those acts of violence, those incidences of hate that are common, frequent, carried out in multiple locations, that they are fueled by these policies, by policies of exclusion, particularly at the federal level, the Muslim ban, for example, that feeds into a kind of American imaginary of in which Arab Americans are thought of, as I've mentioned before, as other, as perpetually foreign, right? So I think that it's hard to disentangle the issue of sort of individual violence or hate incidences carried out on the bodies of Arab Americans from larger policies, including policies that are international, right? So this question of how do we understand the racialized experience of Arab Americans, in my view, has to be understood with a transnational lens. I mean, we have Arab Americans in this country for many reasons, but one of them is because so many of their families have been rendered refugees by American state policy, and most especially the carrying out of wars against Arab populations.
Maya, I wanted to come back to you on the issues that you'd begun to lay out for us around the census. Can you say a bit more about the campaign to include new categories and what that could mean for Arab American communities?
Oh, absolutely. It'd be transformative. When I say rendered invisible in the data, it is because there has been a massive undercount of our community historically. And so anywhere from medical research, we believe there's a higher prevalence of diabetes in our community. And we have medical researchers who tell us, I don't know what the denominator is. I can't conduct accurate research on our community because I don't know, you know, how to get that number. And I have to actually just mention this additional point because Sarah was talking about hate crimes. And we do a great deal of work on hate crimes. Arab Americans were part of the reason, when you look at the Hate Crime Statistics Act that was passed back in 1990, were actually part of the reason for the passage of that act. There were congressional hearings looking at a then FBI director deemed Arab Americans as being in what he called a zone of danger. We were literally targeted with extreme violence. And Sarah mentioned the murder of civil rights advocate Alex Oda was part of that. And at the time, we had something called Code 31, which was a category for anti-Arab hate, and it existed in the other categories. We lost that category for reasons that are not clear to us. As hate crime data progressed from 1990 until 2015, there was no anti-Arab hate category that could be tracked. So when you ask me the question about our polling and how far it went back to, I can only cite you hate crime data on Arab Americans starting in 2015. So we go back to when it's time to, in a post 9/11 environment, institute a program like NSEERS and target people from Arab countries and deport countless numbers of Arab men back to the Arab world, we can find them. When it comes time to identifying victims of hate crimes, when it comes time to allocating trillions of dollars of government resources tied to census data, we can't find us.
That was Executive Director of the Arab American Institute, Maya Berry, and Historian and Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC, Sarah Gualtieri. Maya, Sarah, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. It's been a pleasure to be with you today. And also, thank you, Maya.
I'm so grateful for the conversation. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Melissa. And I think that for a community that's often ignored, the importance of talking about this with your viewers is really appreciated. Thank you so much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Redistricting is underway in many states as lawmakers are drawing new political lines for state and congressional seats. a collaboration between the Princeton Electoral Innovation Lab and Represent Us, started handing out redistricting report cards to keep a check on bad actors as they draw new political maps.
Have you gentlemen seen your midterm grades yet?
The final congressional map in Texas earned a big ol' F for pretty clearly trying to advantage Republican lawmakers.
A fine example, you said.
North Carolina passed a new congressional map just last week. Their grade, also an F, for the same reasons.
F.
An F?
And let's take a look at Ohio, where state Republicans have submitted a draft for their congressional map. Another F.
Well, how did I do?
How'd you do? Offhand, I'd say you failed.
Failed?
And gerrymandering political maps is just one part of this conversation. In 2021 alone, at least 19 states enacted 33 laws that make it harder for Americans to vote. Some estimates are even higher. And these laws largely impact voters of color. Last week, Senate Republicans blocked the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which would have restored voting protections the Supreme Court weakened in 2013's Shelby versus Holder. This is the third voting rights bill Republicans have rejected this year. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke on the Senate floor after the vote.
Just because Republicans will not join us doesn't mean Democrats will stop fighting. This is too important. We will continue to fight for voting rights and find an alternative path forward.
Here with me is Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones, covering voting rights. Ari, it's always great to talk with you.
Hey, Melissa. Great to talk to you again, as always. Thank you.
All right. So we're just 3 months into map making. How's it going?
It's going pretty much as we expected, which is very, very badly. This redistricting cycle is very fraught for two big reasons. It's the first redistricting cycle in more than 50 years where states with a long history of discrimination, like North Carolina, Texas, Georgia, do not have to approve their redistricting maps with the federal government under the Voting Rights Act. And it's also the first redistricting cycle in which the Supreme Court has said that they will not review partisan gerrymandering in federal court. And I think these two decisions together have really emboldened lawmakers, particularly Republicans, to go as far as they can in drawing extreme maps.
Okay, so they're not going to consider partisan gerrymandering, but racial gerrymandering is still unconstitutional. Is that right?
That is right. And that's really where the gutting of the Voting Rights Act comes into effect, because the Voting Rights Act prevented places like Texas and North Carolina and Georgia from enacting discriminatory maps. It still prevents them from enacting those discriminatory maps, but beforehand, they would have had to get those maps approved, meaning they couldn't go into effect if they were discriminatory. Now they can pass discriminatory maps, but you can only challenge them after the fact in very lengthy litigation. I think that Republicans are basically saying, we're going to take our chances. You might strike down these districts in 2028 when this works its way through the courts. But in the meantime, we're going to pick up a bunch of seats, whether we do it through partisan gerrymandering or whether we do it through racial gerrymandering. We don't think these maps are going to be struck down at all. But if they are struck down, they're not going to be struck down immediately.
Right. So it puts the locus of having to actually sort of take the first step, pay for all the litigation on organizations like NAACP, LDF, local organizations. But I am assuming that in places like Texas and North Carolina, they are, you know, watching closely and probably ready to start filing.
They are watching closely, and there's already been lawsuits filed against the state legislative and congressional maps in places like North Carolina and Texas. It's going to be difficult to win those cases, but also what voting rights advocates are most concerned about is what's happening at the local level. Because remember, there's redistricting happening on all the local levels as well for city council and county commissions and all of those kind of things. And that's where there aren't enough lawyers to monitor every single county doing their local redistricting in Texas or Georgia or North Carolina. And we're already hearing a lot of examples of Black members, Latino members who held their seats for 30 years on the county commission and are now having them redrawn and dismantled at the local level. And that's the kind of thing that the Voting Rights Act stopped as well. So there's going to be some people that fall through the cracks here. And there's going to be some discriminatory actions that would have been blocked under the Voting Rights Act that are allowed to go through and may be challenged only after lengthy litigation or may not be challenged at all if groups don't have enough resources to litigate all these cases.
Right. And for ordinary citizens, sometimes the language of redistricting sounds very innocuous, like, oh, we're going to move to at-large districts, right? Or we're going to move a couple of these districts into other ones. And it doesn't sort of sound right off the top the way that that could have these, deeply problematic outcomes for particularly representatives of color.
Exactly. And even someone like myself, I get a map. I don't know what that map means. I don't know the local geography of every county in Texas or North Carolina. I mean, I'm learning a lot more than I did, but
I was like, I'm kind of shocked to hear that, Ari. I actually thought you might.
This is a very inaccessible process for most people. And most people are not paying attention to politics in general in 2021. And most people are not paying attention to redistricting. And what they don't realize is that these maps are going to go into effect for the next decade. So the decisions made right now are going to affect people for the next decade. And also, in a lot of these smaller rural counties, it took 30, 40 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 to elect the first Black or Latino or Asian or Native American members of a county commissioner or of a city councilor. And once you erase those kind of things, it's not going to be very easy to get those kind of gains back.
Right. And then it has this long-term effect. If you can't hold the state house seat, then you can't hold the state Senate seat, then you can't run for Congress. And then, right, you're sort of never eligible for those higher levels.
Exactly. And not only that, but local representation really matters to people. People often know their city council member, their county commission member, a lot more than their member of Congress or their governor. And that actually affects them more in their day-to-day lives.
Let's start with Texas, big state, deeply diverse, but are the districts going to represent this new Texas diversity, especially since they got a whole nother seat?
No, and that's really a trend that we're seeing across the South, Melissa, which is there's these huge population gains, almost entirely from people of color, from Latinos, African-Americans, Asian-Americans, multiracial people, but those gains aren't translating into political power. So Texas actually increased the number of majority white districts and decreased the number of Black and Latino and Asian districts, both for its congressional maps and for its state legislative maps, even though 95% of population growth in the state came from communities of color. So we're seeing through the gerrymandering process, basically attempts to completely nullify and just flat out ignore the demographic changes that are happening in the South and preventing those demographic changes from leading to shifts in political power.
Also in the South, here in North Carolina, where I live, there's this wild district that keeps getting redrawn, seems like every 6 months. Can you talk to us a little bit about what's going on in Carolina?
Well, North Carolina, as you know, was really the epicenter of gerrymandering in the last redistricting cycle. They passed two different congressional maps that were both struck down in court, one for racial gerrymandering, one for partisan gerrymandering. And they're basically doing the same kind of thing that the courts told them not to do in the last cycle, which is they are drawing districts in which Republicans will hold 10 or 11 congressional districts out of 14 total. So they're basically going to hold over 70% of seats in a state that's basically 50-50 divided. And they're doing that by targeting communities of color. There could be fewer Black members of Congress, according to their congressional plan. There could be one-third fewer Black state senators, one-fifth fewer Black state reps. I mean, so you're talking about a very diverse state that is getting more diverse, but white power is being entrenched and overrepresented based on the maps that Republicans are drawing in North Carolina.
Well, and some are suggesting that this angst about North Carolina is related to the outsized and critically important role that Georgia played in the last presidential and congressional elections. So what is going on with Georgia redistricting as well?
They're finalizing their redistricting maps right now. They haven't introduced their congressional maps, but at least for their state legislative maps, particularly their state Senate maps, we're seeing the same kind of thing, which is that Georgia is another state, gained almost 1 million people in the last decade, 100% of that growth from communities of color. But in the state Senate plan they drew, they didn't draw a single new majority minority district. And basically, they drew districts so that white Republicans are going to remain in control for the entire decade. And even though Georgia's a 50-50 state, basically, Trump won more than half the districts there by more than 15 points. So they're not even remotely competitive. The maps got an F from the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, as you mentioned in your opener. And so, again, what we're seeing throughout all of these places, whether it's North Carolina or Georgia or Texas, these states are becoming increasingly competitive and increasingly diverse. But because of gerrymandering, they're not competitive and they're not diverse, at least in terms of the makeup of the state legislature and the congressional maps.
Of course, there's one aspect of the federal legislature that is sort of permanently gerrymandered, and that's the U.S. Senate, where every state gets two senators, no matter how many people or what their makeup is. Talk to us about how the filibuster connected to the Senate is affecting the capacity to get this voting rights bill through.
You're right. The Senate is the most gerrymandered institution in American democracy. And what it means is that through the filibuster, 41 senators representing just 21% of the country can block legislation that's supported by a huge majority of Americans. So we're seeing that over and over with these voting rights bills. These voting rights bills are very, very popular, supported by 70% of Americans, but a very small minority of senators from very small, rural, overwhelmingly white states can block legislation that would restore voting access for millions of Americans.
Ari, it does feel like these are, you know, I know whenever I'm talking to you, it's always like bad news day to talk to Ari, but these are the really critical sort of rules of the game questions that we just are going to have to answer for the health of our democracy. Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Now, we want to end our show this week by spending a little more time recognizing all you veterans out there. We asked you to call in and share messages for the veterans in your lives.
My name is Fletcher, and I work for an organization called Do Good, and I'm always impressed with the vets. I mean, every story is different, but there's just the resiliency that they show. I work with the vets that are houseless at the moment. And another thing I noticed, even though all the vets that are houseless, if one has a rank of like a sergeant or corporal or whatever the case may be, the other vets still show him respect. They could have been outside the armed forces for any amount of time, but they're all in the same situation and they will still show respect to that rank.
My name's Margie Sved. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm calling to tell you about my 97-year-old father who's still alive, who was a navigator on bombers in Europe and was saved by Tuskegee Airmen. So I am very indebted to the Tuskegee Airmen for having saved his life.
This is Katie from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I am so proud to call in about my most beloved grandmother, Elizabeth Tinnerman Egan, or Betty, as she was known here in Santa Fe. She was a captain in the Women's Army Corps. She was stationed in England during the Blitz. She is my hero and my favorite person and the woman who taught me the most about how you stand by your family, no matter what.
My name is Michael Keating from Worcester, Massachusetts. And the veterans that made a difference in my life before I became one myself was my granddad, who was drafted in World War II at 34 years old and died at Bouvelier, France. And my dad, who at 17 was fighting in that same war in the South Pacific. And of course, my brother and many of my nieces and nephews have come in since. It's a family affair here at the Keatings. And I'm very proud to have been in their company, either in spirit and in life.
And we got this lovely message from the daughter of the Takeaways amazing line producer, Air Force veteran, Jackie Martin.
My name's Aurelia, and I live in New York, and I want to wish my mom a happy Veterans Day.
Oh, that voice. Before I go, let me give my team a quick shout out. Our senior producer is Ethan Oberman. Our producers are Meg Dalton, Katarina Barton, Deborah Goldstein, and Joseph Gedeon. Shanta Kevington is our planning editor. Zachary Bynum is our digital editor. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer. Jay Cowan is our director. And both Vince and Jay sound designed the show. And Milton Ruiz helped out on the boards this week. Jackie Martin, our vet, is also our line producer. And Doria Warren is our co-host for Takeaway Deep Dives. David Gable is our administrative assistant, and Mary Croak is keeping it all together as our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.